The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're telling spooky stories about monsters, both real and imagined. A little later, we'll speak to science writer Matt Kaplan about the possible real-world inspiration for some of fiction's most enduring creatures. But first, let's get the scientific perspective on the internet's favorite shambling horror, the zombie. Frank Swain is the man behind the National Geographic science blog, Science Punk, and he appears to have written for every decent media outlet in the UK. He's also worked at the Royal Statistical Society, heading a government-funded project to develop science workshops for journalists. Before that, he was with Sense About Science, co-editing There Goes the Science Bit, a report by the Voice of Young Science group investigating dodgy science claims in advertising. He's here to talk about his first book, How to Make a Zombie. Great to have you here, Frank.
Thank you very much for having me.
So where did we get the idea that there were real-life zombies in the first place?
Well, if we wanted to go right back to the very inception of the popularization of the zombie myth, that would be a man called Lafcadio Hearn, which is a fantastic name, and he was a fantastic writer. He lived at the time in New Orleans, and he was a fantastic writer responsible for really popularizing the mythos surrounding the city as this sort of gateway to the tropics of, having this supernatural edge to it. And one of the dispatches he sent whilst traveling through the Caribbean to Harper's Bazaar was this story of the Walking Dead. So he had a keen interest in folklore, and he set out to try and uncover what these stories of the Walking Dead were. And that is really, I guess, the beginning of the Western world's infatuation with the zombie as a monster.
Well, many of the stories were from Haiti, right?
Lafcadio actually wrote about them in Martinique, so a nearby island. It was William Seabrook who traveled there, sort of a mad, bad, and dangerous to know type character. Fantastically interesting as well. And again, another writer with a real keen sense of wonder about witchcraft and such like. And William Seabrook traveled to Haiti in, I think, about 1930. And during his time there, he wrote quite extensively on zombies and even went so far as to arrange a meeting with a zombie. When he published that book, The Magic Island, it was an absolute phenomenal success. So even though Lafcadio sort of gets the biscuit for being the first one to write about it for the Western world, it was William Seabrook who was really responsible for blowing the zombie myth right up.
There are some fascinating histories in your book. People finding long-lost relatives working on plantations.
It's fascinating because there's quite a difference between the zombies that Lafcadio Hearn found and the zombies that William Seabrook found. So Lafcadio Hearn was traveling there when he was staying with the family, and he asked them to describe what these zombies were, hearing that they were these people raised from the dead. And he got very cryptic answers in reply. And so people would tell him, oh, no, a zombie is something that makes disorder at nighttime. It's a three-legged horse passing you in the road, or these great fires you see on the horizon as you walk towards the light of these fires. They keep moving further and further away from you, and it's zombies that light those fires. And so it was a very, almost like the Western idea of a poltergeist or something like that. It was sort of very disembodied and strange and creepy and prankful. And when William Seabrook got there, sort of 30, 35 years later, it had changed. And the myth of the zombie very much became this solid idea of it was someone who was raised from the dead and forced to work against their will. And those were the cases he was finding. These people were his relatives. They said their relatives had been stolen from them and had been killed and then raised as zombies or just turned directly into zombies. What happened in that intervening time was, of course, the U.S. occupation of Haiti with regards to propping up the interests of the Haska Sugar Company there. And it's that sort of disenfranchisement. It was a really a return. Remember, of course, Haiti being the first, place that threw up its colonial masters and took, it was the first black republic, independent black republic, as it were. And so to have that and then to lose that autonomy again and be pushed back into a situation which was very not good, I think that really helped people focus this idea of a zombie as someone who has been disenfranchised, someone who has been enslaved in a certain way. And it's worth saying that in Haiti, the fear is not of zombies themselves. They're seen as very harmless creatures. The fear is being turned into a zombie. That's what they're really afraid of.
So the idea was that they were under a spell or cursed or some such?
It's interesting. Again, it's such a fluid narrative, but I guess the broadest interpretation of it would be that you are administered some kind of poison, you fall ill, and everybody thinks you're dead, and then the witch doctor comes to you, and whilst you're still in your tomb and you haven't, your spirit hasn't moved too far away from your body, they snatch that sort of that spirit, that independent part of you out of the air, and then they're able to reanimate the body, but without you to control it. And so they are able to take control of your body. And for this reason, there's a superstition of having to guard the dead in Haiti to protect them against any marauding witch doctor who might come and try and steal one of your family to work as a slave.
And so people have tried to conduct some research as to what kind of toxin could do that.
Of course, these stories circulated for a long time, and they're great stories, but that doesn't justify any kind of scientific expedition to uncover the truth of them until this case of a man called Claudius Narcisse. Narcisse was unique in that his death had been recorded. So he had a death certificate. He died in a U.S.-run hospital, and his sister had identified the body. And yet 18 years later, she stumbles across him in a marketplace and, huge shock and horror. And he relates this story that he's been poisoned and forced to work on a plantation. And of course, when news of this got out, people were very keen to find out what this toxin might be. It could, if there was a toxin that, according to Narcisse's story, rendered him in a death-like state, but completely conscious and aware of what was going on around him. That's obviously of medical interest. And so they dispatched a team from Harvard to try and uncover the truth of this poison.
And?
That was Wade Davis. So Wade Davis has certainly made a name for himself with his trip to Haiti to try and uncover this this zombie poison. And he identified, having seen the potions being prepared, tetrodotoxin. That was his sort of likely candidate, as it were. So this is the poison of the pufferfish, which affects the nervous system and causes paralysis. And this is the same reason that people who eat the Japanese delicacy fugu, made from pufferfish, are sort of dicing with death every time they do, because it's this poison which is gives the delicacy its dangerous edge. And was it or wasn't it? Yes, tetrodotoxin does have these effects. Were the actual potions that Wade Davis saw being prepared effective in that same way? We don't know. There's still a lot of uncertainty. That was the state of things for another 20 years or so until a man called Littlewood, Roland Littlewood, was dispatched to follow up this story for a documentary with National Geographic and Channel 4. He's an anthropologist by trade, and so took a sort of different aspect, as if we look at it. And his team, while they were there, did something really, really interesting that nobody had ever done before. And that was to do a medical analysis of the zombies. And so they met three of these reported zombies and did their battery of tests on them to see if they could figure out some kind of clinical definition of why these people, who are, of course, they're not dead, their limbs aren't falling off them or anything like that. They look like regular human beings, although a little different. What is it about these particular patients that lends them this accusation of being a zombie? And there was different diagnoses for each one. I think there was one seemed to be suffering from fetal alcohol syndrome. Another one was diagnosed with schizophrenia. All three of the patients had some kind of mental impairment. And their decision was that, at least medically, zombieism is nothing more than a superstition built around accommodating this notion of some mental imbalance. In the same way that in Europe, we like to think that people who were psychotic had been possessed by evil spirits. That was sort of our explanation. And this is sort of very, very similar territory. But they also did something else which was absolutely fascinating, and that was to perform DNA tests on these zombies and on their families to see if they really were related. And I hope this isn't too much of a spoiler for anyone who's planning to read the book. But these zombies were not related to the families who had taken them in. And that in itself is fascinating. Why would you adopt someone who, especially in an incredibly poor country like Haiti, there's not a lot of wealth to be had. And so this idea of taking on someone who was almost an invalid in some cases, why would you do that? And the answer seems to be because they're very useful proxies if you're having some kind of feud with someone. Because once you've got a zombie of your own, as it were, you can then level an accusation at someone who you've fallen out with, and you can accuse them of zombifying one of your relatives. And it's, zombieism is the administering of poisons with the intent of creating a zombie is a crime in Haiti. It's in the penal code. So if you have a zombie of your own and you can accuse someone of it, then it's a very convenient way of taking someone out of the picture.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with science writer Frank Swain, author of How to Make a Zombie. Okay, so that's turning healthy people into zombies. But what about raising the dead? There actually seem to be two kinds of experiments here, on animals, usually dogs, and on criminals. So at that point, could anyone just walk in and get a criminal to experiment on?
The history of raising the dead really rests on the twin sacrifices made by both criminals and dogs. So we owe them both a lot. The criminals aspect is a fascinating one. And a lot of our research, our knowledge and understanding of resuscitation medicine. So this is what you or me might have applied to us should we be in a car crash or fall from a great height or be mortally wounded in some way. A lot of this comes from people that we were trying to kill in the first place. And the reason for this is that back in 17th century or so in England, we were terrifically fond of hanging people. We thought capital punishment was a great deterrent. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough of a deterrent because people kept committing crimes, lo and behold. And so we thought, well, we'll add in an extra insult to injury there. And if you were convicted of a crime and you were put to death, your body was automatically allocated to the dissectionists, to the surgeons. And people believed back then that you couldn't go to heaven unless you had all your parts together in the coffin. They believed in that literal resurrection. So this, again, this was passed off in the Murder Act. Goodness, now I'm struggling with mind. I think of 1789, but I may be wrong there. And this Murder Act was passed in that great auspices of politics of being ostensibly for the prevention of crime. But the reality was that medicine was a growing field and they desperately needed cadavers. And so really it was passed to help ensure that all of the surgical schools in England had a ready supply of dead bodies to work with. The problem was that we weren't very good at hanging people. And hanging was the favored method of killing criminals back then, but we weren't very good at it. They hadn't invented long drop hanging where the neck is broken and you're sort of instantly killed. You died by strangulation, and strangulation is a very slow process. And actually diagnosing someone as being dead from it is quite difficult. So we had a situation where people would be hung very badly and then immediately delivered to a surgeon's table who, because they're doctors, of course, they want to save people. And so if there's any chance that they can, they'll give it a try. And so this this situation created a great amount of valuable medical research into surgeons who decided rather than dissect someone, they would try to bring them back to life.
I'm very curious as to the legalities around bringing criminals back to life. Would they be hung again if they were resuscitated? Or is there a one hanging per criminal rule?
Yes, absolutely. This was a big ethical argument of time. There were so many criminals who were being revived by surgeons following their hanging that it was a legal debate. Should they be hanged again? And half of them said, well, no, because they can't be expected to be at fault for the faulty work of the executioner, and that's their fault. And the other half said, no, the sentence was to be hanged until you were dead, and if you're not dead, then you should go back. And so it did have, ethical ramifications.
So what methods were people using to revive the dead?
Well, if we go back to when the first resuscitation societies, they were called humane societies back then, once this idea began to take hold that people who appeared dead might not be dead, there was a great amount of interest in trying to revive them. And this was something, this is quite a new idea. We're used to it now with this idea of being unconscious or being comatose or close to death. But it's actually very hard to tell if someone's dead. And for the longest time, we assumed that if you were insensible for a period of time, you must be dead. So horror, Keller horror, sudden realization that all the people who had been smothered or asphyxiated or drowned, you were speedily putting them into tombs and coffins. They might not actually be dead. This panicked everyone. And so they created these humane societies dedicated to reviving them. And the main ones were some recommendations that we would probably still use today. It involved keeping the victim warm. Say if you dragged someone out of the Thames in London, you would keep them warm, you would rub their chest, you might administer mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. You might use a pair of bellows for that as well. And then there are some more esoteric forms of resuscitation. Probably best that they did go out of fashion. And my favorite one of all of those is the tobacco smoke enema. And so tobacco smoke was seen to be a very excitative substance. And of course, because they're not breathing, you can't put it into their lungs. So what's the obvious alternative? An enema of tobacco smoke.
Obviously.
So if that not alone is a reason enough to not fall into the Thames, because you may wake up the stranger, and your pants around your ankles in a very compromising situation. You wouldn't want that to happen to you.
Okay, so that one is atrocious, but you wrote about one that I believe is more interesting. Katsu is fantastic. You actually used the phrase punching a sheep to life.
Yes, this was an experiment carried out by Dr. Horace Ivey, working as assistant to Dr. Robert Cornish. In Berkeley in 1935 or thereabouts. And Cornish was very interested in this idea of raising the dead. He sort of took it on as a pet project, as it were. And he had various different techniques that he was trying out. And by coincidence, around the same time, the Japanese sport of judo was being popularized around the world. And somehow Cornish got his hands on this judo manual, which included what to do if during training one of your students is knocked unconscious or accidentally killed by a blow from an opponent. And these sort of mystical resuscitation judo moves were known as the katsu, which means it's sort of a catch-all term, but it kind of means wake up in Japanese. And so they thought, well, we'll give this a go. You know, if the Japanese have been doing it for 1,000 years, then it might have some merit. And so they strapped a ram to the table and they asphyxiated it. And then they attempted to punch it to life. It didn't work, unfortunately. Perhaps they didn't use the right katsu. There are seven different katsu for various different injuries that someone may have had inflicted upon them. History sadly does not recall which particular katsu they used, but we do know that judo chopping a lamb's life sadly hasn't made it past the research stage.
You made my day with that, sir, just for reference. So now, again, the seeming success of a lot of these reanimations are just due to the fact that people weren't quite dead yet. And it's because of that blurry line between life and death. But are we doing any better with that? It's still blurry, is it not?
It's blurry and getting blurrier, I think, is the way to describe it. If there's one thing that writing this book has really taught me or reinforced in my mind, is that our concept of death and life as this black and white binary system is very, very flawed. It's not reality at all. And really, you're not dead. There's an expression, not dead until you're warm and dead, which reinforces this point that you can always appear dead. They're talking about hypothermia, this idea that if you cool someone down, then they're a lot more likely to be able to be revived. And it's really this question of how much damage can your body tolerate and how much can you repair as a doctor before you pass the point of no return. And even now, we don't really balk at the idea that someone was dead for a couple of minutes here or dead for a few minutes there, hit by lightning and they died for 2 minutes, but then the doctors brought them back to life. And of course our TV shows and movies are full of it, all these people doing CPR, and it only takes about sort of 30 seconds when they do that. In reality, probably It takes a lot longer if you're successful at all. But we're very used to this idea of being able to bring people back from the dead. And research is very much ongoing and very much all about expanding that gray area and taking people who normally would say there's absolutely no chance we can save them and pushing it a little bit further with various techniques. So the most, well, one that's really being investigated now is this idea of cooling someone. And if you can cool people down, then your brain uses less oxygen, your organs, all of your metabolism drops. And so you're not using as much energy. And so you don't need as much. It doesn't matter so much that you're not breathing because your body isn't consuming as much oxygen as it would be. And it's a question of how fast can we cool someone down and how long can we keep them that cold? There's a clinical trial that is running in the US at the moment, which is looking at pushing that to about an hour. So you're looking at patients who are cooled down so much that their heart stops. They are what we might have called dead in a past time because they've got no heartbeat. But because they're so cold, that's not a problem. They're not getting any worse. And that buys the surgeons a little bit of extra time to fix the problem, to fix whatever's wrong with them. And then they can be warmed up again. And lo and behold, they'll, you know, hopefully, fingers crossed, come back to life. That's the plan anyway.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be back to talk more with How to Make a Zombie author Frank Swain after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm discussing the science of zombies with Frank Swain, National Geographic science blogger at Science Punk, and the author of How to Make a Zombie. Now, if one wanted to make a zombie, and of course, really, who doesn't, you could do it via mind control. So maybe just tell us about some of the research into that.
Mind control is certainly something that we've fantasized, I think, about for a long time. And humans, you know, being a species that spends so much of its time thinking and values free thinking so much, it makes it a very big fear that someone might be able to take control of your mind. And of course, the most famous one that I think many of your listeners will be familiar with is the CIA's MKUltra program. So this was a clandestine attempt to investigate lots of different ways of controlling someone's mind using sort of sound waves and sleep deprivation and hypnotism and, of course, lots and lots of drugs. LSD was fairly new around then. And, of course, it was the 60s, so it was party time all round. And all kinds of different agents, sodium pentanol and truth drugs and serums and all that kind of thing. And we still don't know how much success they've really got with that. But in all likelihood, it's very little, I imagine. If there was more, we'd probably know about it. But when the program was uncovered, it had essentially been a bit of a black book. You know, they'd spent colossal amounts of money on this and hadn't really told anyone. There was very little overview. And just as the scandalous nature of this program was brought to light, almost all of the records associated with it were destroyed. So we don't know what they did. We don't know if the CIA has some sort of mind control drugs. But maybe I've been, you know, maybe they got to me too. Maybe I've been programmed to tell you that.
So do we know if there are any drugs that would make someone susceptible enough to do someone else's nefarious bidding?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's the one we know and use every day, and that's alcohol. We drink alcohol because it, you know, of its disinhibition effect. We take it to do things that we, I guess, you know, want to do, but normally feel socially repressed. You know, it makes you more chatty, and you drink too much, and maybe, as the Romans say, vino veritas, it makes you speak what's on your mind. Certainly, there's that. There are drugs such as, you know, there's these fearful stories of the Burundanga, this Colombian, is a scopolamine drug, comes from a particular tree, and the ruse is that gangs would lace drinks with this. And then so you would be on holiday, you would accept a drink from a stranger, or maybe your own drink would be spiked with this agent, and you wake up 3 days later with a suitcase full of heroin in an airport somewhere with no memory of, you know, how you got there. And of course, you know, that's a fantastic story. That's a, again, this it taps into our fears that someone might be able to slip us something and make us do something that we wouldn't, and we wouldn't have any memory of it. But in terms of actual hard evidence that there are drugs that can do this, there isn't very much at all.
So what about hypnosis? That's something that we usually hear of, Manchurian candidate style.
There is a fantastic story of an English doctor in India in around the turn of the century, faced with an epidemic of a particularly nasty little worm that would find its way into the scrotums of men, and they would grow very swollen. And it was a very painful surgery to try and remove this accumulation of fluid. And this doctor didn't have anything that he could give them for the pain. And so he decided to have a go at hypnotism to convince them that they weren't feeling any pain at all when this procedure was carried out. And remember, this is someone taking a knife to your nether regions. This is absolutely not something you would think that you could grin and bear and then talk yourself out of feeling it. But lo and behold, it was a great success. The doctor had patients queuing out of the door. Everyone came around for this painless surgery. The human mind can be encouraged to do things that are, you know, incredible. Your capacity to self-delude yourself is, I think, much bigger than people realize.
But that being said, can somebody be encouraged to do something they don't at all want to do?
That's the real question, isn't it? Is there, this is what the CIA wants, this is what the witch doctors want, what cult leaders want, a drug that doesn't simply push you off the path, but actively makes you do things that you wouldn't ever have done normally. I don't know of any drugs like that. There are certainly drugs that can be dissociative, like alcohol, that can make you behave in ways that you might regret, but at the time were at least the thing that you wanted to do. But drugs that would actively make you do something that deep down you didn't want to do, I don't know of any, and I'm kind of happy that I don't, because it might not exist.
I was going to say, that's actually the first reassuring thing you've said. Thank you. But mind control does seem to have been perfected, just not in humans, by parasites. So I want you to tell us about the emerald cockroach wasp, because it's awful.
Exactly. Emerald cockroach wasp is one of my favorite little organisms. It's a beautiful little wasp. It's a tiny little sliver of iridescent green. And as the name suggests, its life cycle is intimately bound up with its prey, the cockroach. So it is a parasite, and it chooses to parasitize cockroaches. And what it does is it wants to lay its egg on there. It wants to have its young have a food supply like a lot of animals. But the problem with laying your egg on near a food supply, like, you know, flies might lay their eggs in the garbage, is that somebody comes along and clears the garbage away. Or maybe a scavenger might come along and eat the garbage before your eggs have a chance to hatch. So laying your eggs on living prey is a lot, you know, is the obvious next step. But the cockroach, understandably, isn't too keen on being a food source. And so the wasp has a way of getting around this. And it finds a cockroach when it's ready to lay an egg and stings it in the side. And the wasp is very, very small. It's not much of a match physically big cockroach. So it stings it inside, and then this venom paralyzes the cockroach temporarily. And this is really just to buy that wasp enough time to climb up and deliver a much more precise sting right down into the head of the cockroach, into what passes for the brain of the cockroach. It uses these little feelers on its sting to sort of find the right spot. And when it does, it injects a second dose of venom there. And this eradicates, this sort of dissolves what you might call the free will inside the cockroach. So when the first sting wears off and the cockroach can run away if it wanted to, it doesn't. It can walk, but it doesn't run away. It sort of just stays there and doesn't do too much. And so the wasp grabs it by the antenna, almost as if it was a dog on a leash, and leads this cockroach into a burrow that the wasp had prepared, lays an egg on there and closes up the burrow, and doesn't close up the burrow because it's worried the cockroach might escape. It closes up the burrow just to make sure nothing else comes in to eat that sort of zombified cockroach. And the cockroach will wait there quite happily whilst the egg hatches, and it'll wait while the grub sort of burrows into its side and begins eating its organs. And it'll wait there as this little grub eats all of the internal organs, quite disgustingly, in an exact sort of order that will keep the cockroach alive as long as possible. And eventually then it dies. And just like the movie all of you will be familiar with the scene with John Hurt. The wasp bursts out of the cockroach's corpse as an adult and goes off to repeat the process. You know, the like beautiful circle of life rolls around one more time. So yeah, a very nasty little parasite, but also a gloriously nasty one as well.
So, but that's the cockroach at least sitting there doing nothing. There's another parasite that actually has the ability to make its host commit suicide, which is lovely. The Gordian worm.
The Gordian worm, another animal with a wonderful name. It's another name for it is a horsehair worm because you find it in troughs of water where you might keep animals. And it's long and thin. It ties itself into sort of these bundles of knots, like the mythical Gordian knot. Again, it lays its eggs in these burrows, and when they hatch, it has its incredibly sort of complex life cycle, which seems to revolve around a lot of really good coincidences. It's amazing that any of these animals survive at all. But the first stage is it burrows into a snail, and once it's in there, then it waits to be sort of burrowed into something else, and so on and so forth. But the ones that are really great get into a larvae, somewhere floating near the surface. And those larvae, insect larvae, eventually take off and become crickets, whatever they might be. And the worm grows inside them, and it grows inside them, and it grows inside them. And these crickets go about their daily business, don't realize that there is a parasite lodged inside of them, growing bigger every day. And so that parasite is ready to reproduce, but now it has a problem. It burrowed into the, you know, into this thing when it was in water, and now it's on dry land. So the adult worm can only live in water, and it has a bit of a problem. How is it going to get back to water? Crickets, they can't swim. They don't really like water that much. And so somehow this worm changes the way that the grasshopper behaves and compels it to find some water and to jump into the water. And we're still not exactly sure whether it simply makes these animals hop and hop and hop and hop until they sort of get to some water and just keep hopping straightforwards into it, or whether they somehow tap into that sense of the grasshopper to search out a pool of water and to throw itself in. But either way, these grasshoppers, much more than their uninfected brothers and sisters, end up throwing themselves into a body of water. And once that happens, the worm will burrow out of them. It's absolutely huge compared to the grasshopper by this point. There's videos you can see online of Gordian worms emerging from their hosts, and they're quite horrible to watch. I'm not sure whether that's better or worse than the cockroach. I guess it depends whether you'd rather be eaten alive or drowned. But that's your choice.
That's quite the choice. Good. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm joined by science punk Frank Swain, author of How to Make a Zombie. And he is currently making me mildly uncomfortable. So after all your research, as the book is called How to Make a Zombie, what is the best way to make a zombie? What would you be pulling from if you wanted a zombie army?
I guess, first of all, you have to decide which format you're going with. Really, the raising the dead aspect, we're pretty good at it, but it's very labor-intensive, isn't it? And at least using the medical procedures that we have today, the person, when they wake up, will be thankful probably, but probably not so thankful that they're willing to join you in some kind of Armageddon army. And again, with noxious drugs and poisons and chips and brains and things like that, they don't self-replicate. So it's you've got to have a huge barrel of LSD if you're hoping to dope everyone into being part of your personality cult. It's got to be the parasites. If you could maybe become almost like a parasite yourself, if you could convince mosquitoes to carry around some agent of your own choosing, which would spread it from person to person, or a virus, you know, and of course, most of our zombie films that we see in the cinemas today use viruses because it's so much more convenient. Back in the 1930s and 40s, zombie films generally revolved around witchcraft, but that involves one poor witch doctor having to raise all the different people. It's very, like I say, labor-intensive. Take a leaf out of Hollywood's books, create yourself a zombie virus, and let nature do its work for you.
So how about toxoplasmosis? Because my idea is that we need to modify that if, of course, we wanted a zombie army.
Yes, so toxoplasmosis is a fascinating little piece of biology. It comes from, it's a condition you might get if you were infected by a parasite called Toxoplasma gondii. It's a parasite of, a single cell parasite of rats and cats. And cats are really its main host. It can only complete its life cycle inside of a cat. But it likes to spread around, as all good organisms try to do. And so it's shed from the cat in the feces and is picked up by rodents. And this bug will infect anything warm-blooded. It's not particularly choosy. And so it gets into these rats, and the rats carry it around. Now, it's in a rat, but it can't complete its life cycle there. And just like the worms, the Gordian worms and their water-fearing hosts, rats don't really like cats. That's sort of a fundamental part of being a rat, is that you do not enjoy the company of cats, and for good reason. And this is a problem for the Toxoplasma gondii. It needs to get itself back into a cat, and it doesn't have legs. It's, like I say, a single-celled organism. It can't just sort of sprout out and go looking for a cat. And so it begins to change the way the mouse behaves. And it slows down the mouse's reflexes. It makes them come out during the daytime and to explore new areas. And rats are normally very, very fearful, very timid, very careful creatures. And this parasite convinces them to engage in much more reckless behavior. And all of these combined eventually ensure that that rat is caught by a cat. And thus the life cycle is completed. So, but what's really interesting, as I said earlier, this parasite will infect almost anything warm-blooded, including ourselves. And if you do have this parasite, it's sort of very common to pick up during the course of your lifetime through eating unpasteurized foods. There's a small amount of evidence to suggest that we are subtly influenced in the same way as this thing influences mice. And so this parasite almost thinks it's in a mouse, if you want to conceptualize it that way. And people who show exposure to this parasite tend to have reflexes that are a little bit slower. And there's a fantastic bit of research by a professor called Professor Jaroslav Pfleger in Prague. And he looked at people who got into car accidents. You know, there's a consequence of reckless behavior. And he discovered that people who got themselves into car crashes were almost three times more likely to show exposure to this parasite than the general population. So it implied that, yes, maybe this bug gets into people and has this same effect on them. Now, the important thing is to say that these effects are very, very subtle. It's the kind of thing you would only see at a population level. So please, all of the listeners here today, don't go and throw your cat out the window. You wouldn't get it from a cat anyway, unless you were sort of, you know, munching your way through its litter box. And more to the point, this is, like I say, a very, very subtle effect, but it does open up a fascinating idea, which is that we are so used to this idea that you might have bacteria in your gut, you might have a skin infection, you might have a cold. We're used to the idea of our body being colonized by other organisms, but our brain, and especially the way that we like to think is sacrosanct. We like to believe that there's absolutely nothing going on there except what we ourselves are thinking. And that might not be true. Your mind and the way that you think is a combination of lots of different things. And one of those things might be another living organism that isn't you. And so people who are listening today can think about this and say, if they do enjoy driving a little bit too fast, if they enjoy roller coasters or gambling or picking fights with large dogs or whatever it might be, maybe these behaviors are a little bit influenced by the parasite inside you. And if they were, would you want to get rid of them?
Before we go, I have one last question, because I couldn't help but note that you wrote practically nothing about how to kill a zombie. And so I'm a bit worried about whose side you're on. But if there was a zombie uprising, what's our game plan?
You've got to go for the head. I think in all my reading and writing, I don't think I found anything that so far can live without a head, except for cockroaches. And even they starved to death eventually with no heads. So Hollywood got that one right as well.
Frank, wonderful to have you here.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
And we'll be right back with Matt Kaplan to get more on the science of monsters after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're taking science out of the lab and into everyday life. Guest host Rochelle Saunders speaks to Dennis Trumbull, senior biomedical engineer at Allegheny General Hospital, about his book, The Way of Science, Finding Truth and Meaning in a Scientific Worldview. Desiree Schell talks to Bobby Duffy, managing editor of the Ipsos Mori Social Research Institute, about the top 10 mistakes the British public make about statistics. And she speaks to Katie Gibbs of Evidence for Democracy, a group that advocates for the transparent use of science and evidence in Canadian public policy. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Matt Kaplan. Matt's been writing about science and technology in The Economist for years. His articles also frequently wind up in National Geographic, Scientific American, Nature, and New Scientist. When not at his desk, Matt makes a good effort at getting himself killed on expeditions in far-flung regions of the world, from Tasmania to the Alaskan bush. He's here today to talk about his book, The Science of Monsters. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Matt.
Glad to be here.
So if I was to tell someone about this book, I'd call it a thought experiment about literary and legendary creatures. Could these creatures have existed? And if not, what might have made people invent them? Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, it is a fair summary. The concept is to look at monsters throughout history and ask the question, what was it that made people believe in these things? Of course, you can always rely on the argument, oh, well, they just made them up because they had imagination. But we're incredibly bad at imagining things all on our own. Most of our imaginings have form and structure from the stuff that we see around us. Just take a look at the earliest monsters like the Chimera or the Nemean lion. These creatures are carnivores. They are predatory. And people at that time in history were living in places where predatory animals were a serious threat. And as a result, those fears manifest in the form of the monsters that they created in their stories.
So what brought this book on exactly?
I'm a science journalist. I've been writing for The Economist for years, the science section there. And I was contacted by a history teacher who was trying to teach students to get more excited about history by using monsters as a vehicle. So he was bringing in things like the Minotaur and Medusa and saying, look, you know, while these creatures weren't real, they played a part in ancient culture and history. And the students started asking him, okay, well, these people in these ancient periods were inventing these creatures. Did they have any scientific basis? And seeing as this friend of mine was a history teacher and not a scientist, he called me up and he said, I've just been asked if it's possible whether the concept of people being turned to stone by Medusa came as a result of people looking at petrified humans in fossil rock beds. And I said, well, I honestly don't know if that's where the myth came from, but I can certainly tell you that all throughout the Middle East and ancient Greece, you do get fossilized bones. Many of them are mammalian. Some of them are even our ancient ancestors. And when bones are petrified in the fossil record, they do turn to stone. And so it makes some logical sense that if somebody were to stumble upon a mammal bone that had been petrified, they would try to come up with some sort of explanation for why the bone had been turned to stone. And so thus, you can start to hypothesize as to where a myth like Medusa would have come from.
Well, speaking of hypotheses, you actually hazarded a few educated guesses as to why humans are so attracted to monsters.
There are a lot of reasons why we like to scare ourselves. So there's a psychologist named Paul Rosen who has theorized that we like to scare ourselves with roller coasters and horror movies because it releases endorphins that are similar to the sort of stuff that comes about when we eat things like hot chili peppers. It gives us a rush realizing that while our body is freaking out, we know things are safe. That certainly plays a role. We like to scare ourselves because the feeling of our body being afraid while we consciously know we are in no danger yields a sense of pleasure. The other aspect to monsters that's very powerful is the fact that if you can't encounter the dangers in the world around you, if you can't do it directly because it's just too risky, one way to help people to be prepared for the dangers in the world around them is to tell them stories of dangerous things so that they can imagine what they would do if they were presented with danger. I like to call that the sandbox argument, where you play with things in the sandbox because it's safer there. If kids were living in a clan or a town where there were lions nearby, which is the case for most of Europe up until 100 AD, if you didn't want the kids to go and have to actually tangle with lions to have that kind of experience, you could tell stories about a monstrous lion living in the area around you to A, calls them to think about the dangers that are out there and be a little bit more cautious, and B, consider what they might do if they ran into such a creature. And thus, monster stories serve as a social tool for causing people to be prepared for greater dangers around them.
Well, and now, as I said, that's an educated guess, as is much of the rest of the book, which you were very clear about, thank you. So how did you search for potential sources of mythical creatures? Where do you start with that?
You got to go back to the earliest moment when a monster arose. Because once monsters get going, you've got the telephone game going on, where one person tells the story of the monster to another and another and another, and then things get spiraled out of control because, well, that's the nature of human communication. But if you go back to the very earliest records, you get the best chance possible of trying to interpret what people were actually thinking about. A good example, perhaps the best, is the Minotaur. We all know of the Minotaur being half man, half bull. He was slain by Theseus. He lived in the labyrinth underneath Crete. But when you look at the earliest writings on the Minotaur, they actually don't mention the half-man, half-bull nature of the monster at all. They entirely talk about this terrible roaring creature that lives beneath the island. There are descriptions of the roar shaking things. There are descriptions of the monster causing damage to the palace at Knossos. All of these descriptions are associated with something that is living in a labyrinth below ground. We have the ability now, through geological techniques, to calculate out when giant earthquakes occurred. One of the major ways you can do it is by looking at boulders that have washed up on the shore of the Mediterranean. Boulders get thrown out of the Mediterranean periodically, as it turns out, by tsunamis. And when those boulders get thrown out, they have things like starfish attached to them. The starfish die because they either desiccate or get crushed as the boulder rolls around on the surface. And you can carbon date the starfish, which means you can work out when the starfish died. You can work out from that when the boulder was thrown out. You can then calculate how big the wave had to be to cause the boulder to fly out of the water. And then you can determine where that wave came from and calculate out what the earthquake was in the middle of the Mediterranean that caused that effect. So you can effectively fingerprint earthquakes. And, well, wait a minute, the Minotaur roaring underground, that myth seems to take form at the same time that you have these enormous boulders washing up all around the Mediterranean. That's not happenstance, or it could be happenstance, but it seems, if you use the educational guessing, that it is unlikely to be happenstance. All of this is down to educational guessing. But they can put two and two together and say, well, they're talking about big roars that damage buildings in a labyrinth underground at the same time that all these boulders are washing up. Okay, yes, they could be isolated incidents, but it seems less likely. So that's where you start to hypothesize that the Minotaur may have really been born from earthquakes.
Well, and now your background is in paleontology, but as you said, you looked for evidence for these creatures' possible existence in everything from geology to genetics to political climate. So how do all those fit together, and was that hard?
Well, I'm a science journalist for The Economist, so navigating between science and politics and culture and genetics and geology, I mean, these things flow across my desk every day, so it isn't much of an issue. As a science journalist, especially in the area that I'm working, you become a jack-of-all-trades, master of none. That, of course, is dangerous because when you're dealing with, for example, monsters, you'd better understand the classics. You'd also better understand the specific sciences that you're working in. And I don't know if you noticed, there's a huge thank you section in the front of the book, and that's largely down to the fact that as a good science journalist, you realize exactly who you are and what you know, and where you have to go to double-check all the material that you're referencing. So, for example, with the Minotaur, tons of material went over to people like Andrzej Szefers, who's a geologist who specializes in the boulders around the Mediterranean, and geologists who deal with seismology. And so you run that material past folks and make sure that you're not making mistakes.
Well, I have to point out that I particularly enjoyed how you would throw out sort of a credible-sounding hypothesis, and then you would proceed to rip it apart.
It's the nature of good scientific inquiry. You have to propose your theories and then ask, is this reasonable? And you never know for sure whether or not you are or are not right, but when you're trying to scope out what the scientific origins of a monster might be, you've got to use the evidence that you've got and determine whether or not it seems feasible. At the end of the day, it's educated guessing, but some educated guesses, they seem more feasible than others.
So was that fairly reflective of your thought process as you were researching? Sort of, this sounds neat, maybe it could be true. Nope, totally can't be true.
Well, it's funny you should say it sounds neat. I'm not sure that I use those words, but very few of the theories in the book just came from my own inspiration. I will point out again, we are terribly uncreative beings when it comes to coming up with ideas. We develop ideas from the things that we see in the world around us. There are lots of books and lots of materials on where different monsters of different types came from. And so I just spent hours and hours in the library reading all of this material and asking, all right, this is what this person suggests. Does it sound feasible? A really good example is with vampires. There's a large camp that believes that vampires stem from the genetic disorder porphyria, or porphyria, which is exactly as it sounds. It's a genetic disorder that causes people to become highly sensitive to the sun. They are iron deficient and in theory could benefit from blood transfusions. They tend to be very pale. They suffer a great deal, but they burn very quickly in daylight. And so there have been suggestions, well, you know, maybe this concept that vampires, you know, get burned to a crisp in daylight, maybe that's coming from porphyria, and if they drank blood, they would feel better. Maybe that's where the vampire drinking blood theory comes from. And, I mean, I don't buy into any of it because porphyria is so uncommon, and these people would have been very, very ill, non-aggressive in the extreme. It seems very difficult to put those two together. Instead, you turn to things like records of rabies spreading across medieval Europe, and Renaissance Europe for that matter. One person gets bit by a wolf. That person's wound from the wolf heals up. Months later, the rabies virus incubates inside them, and they start to go rabid. Rabies can go one of two ways. You can become very ill, end up in a sickbed, and just die. Or you can become what they call ferocious rabid, which is before you die, you become very aggressive and you will tend to try to bite other people. And if you bite somebody else and break the skin, they carry the infection until they go rabid. So it almost sounds like a Gothic horror novel where one person bites another and they become the monster later. There were huge rabies epidemics across medieval and Renaissance Europe, enormous ones. Many of them are well documented, some of them involving people biting people. And that seems like a very strong reference in association to the werewolf and the vampire legends. And I think it's intriguing that when you look, for example, at the earliest vampire myths, most of them involve wolves. Almost all of them involve wolves. In fact, the only time where you start to see this concept of vampires and werewolves disliking one another, which is brilliantly portrayed in the Twilight movies, I mean, there is an ecological basis for that in that in Eastern Europe, the people living there believed that the werewolves were guardians of their society and protecting them from vampires. And this largely stems from people being buried during rabies epidemics or epidemics of any sort. And if they came into the graveyard, they would find wolves digging up corpses because wolves, while they have this reputation of being predators, they'll scavenge if they can. And if there's a shallow grave where people are just being tossed because they're dying by the dozens, folks walking into the graveyard in the middle of the night would find wolves ripping open corpses, and they could easily come to the conclusion that, wow, this corpse was a vampire rising from the grave, and the wolves got it before it came to us. Therefore, the wolves are our protectors. Similarly, if the corpse was almost entirely consumed and the wolf ran away, they could come to the conclusion the vampire has risen from the grave, transformed into a wolf, and run off, which is why Dracula transforms into a wolf in Bram Stoker's Dracula. So it goes both ways. Different cultures have had different situations, and they saw wolves doing different things and made different assumptions. But that's, I think, why wolves are so tightly associated with the vampire myth.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and I'm joined by Matt Kaplan, author of the book The Science of Monsters. Okay, so you've mentioned a few of the creatures in the book that you go over, but I'd really like to talk about the Chimera. I love that section. First of all, give us some background there.
So the earliest monsters involved single predatory species, things like the Nemean lion was just a lion with a very thick skin, things like the Caledonian boar was just a boar that happened to be very large. Later monsters that you get in classical Greece are things like the Chimera, which is a mix of multiple species in one. You get lion with a goat head or goat body parts mixed in with a snake tail or a snake head, or in later versions, a dragon head mixed in. Some artists portray the creature as a lion's head with a goat's body and a snake's tail. In some cases, you have three heads, a lion, a goat head, and a snake head or a dragon head on a body that is lion-like with some reptilian and goat-like features mixed in. It seems like the stuff of a drug-induced haze. And, hey, look, I don't dismiss that that might be possible. But you can also look at the evidence from the area where these people were living. And certainly Greece is rich in fossils. They're not rich in dinosaur fossils, but they're rich in mammal fossils. You get some really weird stuff. And we know that the Greeks were digging it up because we found things like ancient elephant tusks dug up from the ground in Greece in places like the Temple of Artemis, where they thought it was the tusk of the Caledonian boar, the mythological boar that harmed people. And they stored it there because they thought it was a magical relic of an ancient time. It wasn't a boar tusk, it was an elephant tusk. But, hey, you know, they can be forgiven. They weren't paleontologists. And the fossil beds that are found in Greece are not just isolated fossils. Fossils never show up as isolated animals in a single location. Much more common are for animals to be found in jumbled piles of bone. And jumbled piles of bone do not just involve one animal or one animal species in many cases. You often get animals that all die in one event, let's say a flood, that washes all the bones up into a riverbed and dumps them all in a single layer of sediment. In such circumstances, it's totally possible to find something like a goat and a lion skeleton that got intermingled. And so it is entirely possible that people found the chimera or came up with the chimera idea from that.
Okay, now we've really only spoken about the oldest of creatures, but the book actually dealt with monsters throughout history, all the way up to Hal from the movie 2001 and The Terminator. So do you think our newest monsters are as reflective of our current fears and desires as the ancient ones are?
I do. I think our fears are shifting. They've been shifting for a very long time. Our monsters can teach us a lot. When Jurassic Park came out, both as a book and as a movie, there was a powerful statement being made about what we are capable of when wielding genetics. And there's a line in the movie where the mathematician says to the creator of the park, whose name is John Hammond, "John, you were so eager to see if you could, you never asked if you should," with regards to creating dinosaurs. And certainly when wielding genetics, that is an entirely relevant question that I think many of us genuinely are curious about. With regards to artificial intelligence, we are teaching computers right now to land military drones, to be able to control the military drones, which have guns and missiles on them. And this is not a million miles off from saying, whoa, wait a minute, hold on, war machines that are sentient that can take action without human intervention. That's very Terminator-esque. We're not there yet, but it is reasonable as we imbue our machines with increasing abilities to ask the question, what are they going to be capable of in 50 years from now?
So what do you think our future monsters are going to be like? If the trend in the world is towards that direction, what's the next scary monster?
I find it intriguing that humans play an ever-increasing role in the form that monsters take. You really start to see shifts in the medieval period when the monsters are not just creatures created by the gods, like Chimera or the Nemean lion. In the medieval period, you start to have humans becoming the monster, so vampires. A human bitten by a vampire becomes a vampire. A human bitten by a werewolf becomes a werewolf. That's a major shift in the form that monsters take. Later, you get things like Frankenstein. It's arguable in Mary Shelley's book who the actual monster is, but in terms of the creature that looks hideous and kills people, it certainly is the creation, but the creation is created by Victor Frankenstein, who is human. In Jurassic Park, the people who create the dinosaurs are absolutely human. In the case of Rise of Planet of the apes, which you're cheering for, by the way, they rip people apart, are given their sentience by people, by modern medicine. And I find that fascinating, that we are increasingly putting ourselves in the role of monster or creator of monster. And to a certain degree, we are increasingly becoming afraid of who we are, what we can do.
Matt, great to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
You'll find a link to Matt Kaplan's book, The Science of Monsters, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And if you're so inclined, click the other links to our various social media pages or to iTunes, where you can download past episodes or subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.